Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. We have a great show for you guys. It's a real change of pace. We have Anna Kachin of the Red Scare podcast. She's definitely a little off the DC policy think tank beaten path we really started with, so I hope y'all all are ready to work with us as we figure out how to have an actual conversation on a podcast and not simply go down the lines of industrial policy and semiconductors.
Don't poke too much fun at us, Marshall. We like that stuff around here. Look, Anna is somebody who makes me laugh with almost every observation that she says. And look, one of the things I make reference to is what I was desperate to avoid in this podcast was this cringe thing where right-leaning people bring on someone from the left and are just like, confirm all of my biases about the left. And like that person will play along, but like obviously still has like a lot of different feelings about both the right and like so much more. And like this was just a conversation with one of the most interesting people that I find in the cultural political space. My favorite thing that she said was that she's like, look, I'm not very political. She's like, the only reason I had to become this way is because everything became political. And I can't think what a good indictment just of our current culture war, and so much more. And she is somebody who just, I think, is scathing in all respects, which is, I absolutely love it.
And the key thing here that Sagar got at is the worst version of this show would have been, hey guys, we have a left person who thinks feminists are crazy.
Right.
She thinks that actually Joe Biden is the real destructor. That's right. Just dumb, it's boring, and it never talks about the way the right actually works. So this episode is a special shout out to certain members of the audience who think that just because we critique the left and just because we critique the establishment, everything is peachy keen on the other side of the aisle. Anna is incredibly open and frankly, deeply realistic about the way this actually works. That really comes through.
Yeah, I love that. What's our question for this week, Marshall? Just as a reminder to everybody, if you want to ask us a question, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Really helps other people find the show. And if you write us a 5-star review, you can leave a question there within the review itself or take a screenshot, send it into realignmentpod@gmail.com.
And this question is from Kavan. I want to open this question by saying that I would describe myself as left of center, and that might fuel my confusion on this topic. Is there a potential resolution to the vehement Second Amendment conflict that rips the American political landscape apart? It never seems to change. The narrative that the right wants carte blanche Second Amendment rights, and the left is going to climb through your bedroom window and rip the guns from your sleeping arms. Regardless of who is running and what their platform is, that is what the arguments always seem to boil down to. Is there a middle ground that could ever be reached? Seems like America could do with a bit of unity after the nail-biter of a battle between the lesser of two evils. Thanks for the show. Can never get enough of rational perspectives. Keep up the work, guys.
Well, it's a great question, Kavan. And technically, the answer to your question is yes, but the realistic answer to your question is no. And what did I just reference? When everything becomes culture war, when everything becomes national, when everything becomes extreme, then there is nothing that can be done. There is not a Republican senator who can realistically vote for gun control, and there is not a Democratic senator who can vote for pro-gun. And one of the ways I think about this is I try to think about what the beating hearts of political parties are, and I've increasingly am convinced on the right and left that it is the culture war. And one of the ways that I know that it can compromise somebody, of even somebody who purports to not be able to be compromised, is what are the issues that Bernie had to move on whenever he wanted to become a mainstream Democrat, right? It was, he couldn't endorse pro-life candidates anymore. He had to disavow his past, like, pro-Second Amendment politics, and he had to change his position on immigration. It's like, those are all culture war issues. And if they can move Bernie Sanders, whose whole brand is being implacable, then they can move everybody and nothing is ever going to happen.
Yeah, I want to be very precise when it comes to this question, because a lot of people ask us culture war issues and they ask us, why don't you guys explicitly talk more about them? And it's because of this dynamic. We're not aiming to come here and claim that culture war issues don't matter, whether you're on the left or the right. We're not here to say that economic issues or foreign policy take precedence. That's not the business we're in. What we do want to avoid on this podcast, however, is falling into this culture war trap that you're talking about, which is the second that you go in to the Second Amendment debate, from the left or the right, framing it as such, it's just over. And this is what's so frustrating, and this applies to climate change too. Greta Thunberg seems like a really, really nice young woman who's ambitious and smart, but guess what? She is now a cultural figure of the left.
Yep.
By very specific cultural and technical choices that she made. That's now over. Whoever comes up with a solution for climate change is not going to be the person who chose to dive into that fact. And look, the same thing goes to the right. There are people on the right who have gone way too hard on the paint on the culture wars. So if you're a person who foments your entire identity around the question of, I'm going to fight woke politics, guess who isn't going to be the person who resolves a lot of these cultural fights? So that's the thing that we really want to stress here, which is that if we are going to get out of these situations, diving into the culture wars head on in exchange for clicks, recognition, if you're actually trying to solve the issue long term, that's definitely not going to happen. That is definitely what is happening here with the gun control debate.
100% correct.
But that's a great question. Keep them coming. We really want to do a mix of encouraging people to be optimistic about the future, but also realistic about the way that these debates actually play out. So, got a great episode for you. Before we dive in, shout out to Lincoln Network. Reboot 2020 was amazing. We had a great time hosting everyone over 3 days. Actually saw a lot of people who we know from this show in the attendee list. So thank you so much for coming. And thank you to Lincoln for hosting and sponsoring our work. Let's dive into the episode.
Anna Hatjan, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
That generation of I guess it's Gen Xers, right? Like Eric and such, they belong to a time when it's okay to be informed on racial and ethnic minutiae. Now, if you know you're doing race science and you're like a total like white nationalist freak.
Yes.
And must be scrubbed so just, from the
just
discourse.
For context. For the audience, I was like, is it Akachian? Is it Hachian? And I was we're trying to be respectful, but as Anna points out, by being aware of that, that itself these days is a bit of a problem, which is a great intro, I guess, to all of this, which is, this is the same thing we've been asking everybody on since the election. What's your general reaction to the news? Joe Biden, president-elect, Trump, you know, lost, but like barely. Obviously, you've got all the defund the police talk, who's to blame, all of that. Where do you fall on this? What do you think?
Well, what's the deal? I kind of checked out. Is Joe Biden now officially president-elect, or is it still contested? Who knows?
The electors haven't technically met, so I guess
December 14th is the actual date. That's the actual date on which he will officially be president-elect. Anyway, it did a second. The reason I'm being more confident in saying that is because I've been covering these lawsuits. And, like, honestly, they're just completely bullshit. I mean, basically, like, we each one, like, after the other. And, like, I'm willing to hear it out. I just, you know, every single one that's been happened in court has been dismissed at that point. So what I'm trying to focus on more is, like, the county-level stuff. And, obviously, the takes are flying around. Like, either the GOP is, like, the ascendant working-class party, or actually, you know, Abigail Spanberger is the one blaming AOC, who's, like, actually Black Lives Matter, save the Democratic Party. I'm really curious where you fall on this.
I think I'm like everybody. I think you guys said this on one of your episodes. I'm trying to like paper over my great disappointment with a general sense of apathy and indifference. I'm fairly indifferent ultimately to who wins this particular election. There is, I have to admit, something deeply, deeply demoralizing about Joe Biden becoming president. The return of like the neo-lib consensus. I can understand why people were fired up and galvanized and thrilled by someone like Barack Obama. I don't understand Joe Biden. I think it feels, you know, fake and manufactured.
The thing is, I'm not quite sure anyone was truly fired up about Joe Biden. Maybe there's some weird corner of Northern Virginia or sort of the Westchester County, but I just think most people were fired up by how much they hated Trump. And that'd be pretty honest about that. I don't think there are any Biden stands sort of hanging out there.
Right.
Well, there was, okay, so I live in New York and there was people in the street screaming about, you know, cheering for Biden, which I thought was also completely bizarre and out of touch. I think that people just are not in touch with themselves and their own feelings. You know, Michael Tracy tweeted the other day that the key difference between Democratic and GOP claims of election fraud is that the Democratic claims get amplified eagerly by every organ of the mainstream establishment. Hence, you have something like 2016. And conversely, the GOP claims are subject to like a barrage of disclaimers and censorship, declaring them to be authoritatively false. In my mind, like, look, the real issue is not Biden versus Trump specifically, or Democrats versus Republicans in general, but the fact that one side clearly owns and controls the ideological meta narrative, like the pulleys and levers of ideological conditioning. And, you know, this to me, not like which flavor of like neo-lib gerontocrat sits in the Oval Office, is what I think must be confronted and contested for any of us to have a chance, which by which I mean a future.
I saw your tweet. I saw your tweet on this. I thought it was pretty profound. It's something that we've talked a lot here on the podcast, like in reference to Wes Yang's successor ideology and in kinds of what exactly is coming next, and how one party, or not even one party, one group of people, like an elite substructure or whatever, is controlling this meta narrative. The battle over that is the most important thing. And I guess I want to get this out of the way, because I saw the other tweet that you'd sent on this, which I thought was hilarious, is you were like, these people, you know, keep coming at me. These like the people keep are like, when is Anna going to be, you know, just going to come out and be on the right? And you were like, how about we just, you know, talk to the messenger? And so since I actually literally get to talk to the messenger, I have that. What do you think that critique of the meta narrative, you know, how is that not right wing? Because that's how it's being described. You know, how do you kind of see yourself within this battle, as you put it? What do you think?
You know, I feel like for 4 years now, I felt like the IKEA monkey trapped in like the revolving doors of liberal ideology, you know, looking pathetically out in my little shearling, listening to people like melt down and hyperventilate about Trump and how uniquely bad he is, how much of a Nazi and autocrat. That's not plausible. It's not borne out by observation or experience. I don't think he was a particularly bad president. I don't think he was a particularly good one either. But, you know, as everyone from Eric Weinstein to Glenn Greenwald, and they've had some kind of intellectually adversarial relationship in the past, as I understand it, have pointed out, he's a fairly bog standard neoliberal president. And yeah, so, right. You know, I had a person the other day, an affluent white suburbanite, tell me that like what most bothers them about Trump is how racist he is. Like, what are you talking about? How does this concern you? You can tell that people are kind of lying through their teeth, but yet don't know it, you know, in the sense that, like, I understand being touched by injustice and racism and that sort of thing. But I think it's a proxy for other kind of psychological forces, for the fact that, you know, on the whole, it's a very low stakes, no goals game for like the affluent white suburbanites who voted somebody like Biden into office, because, you know, they never have to confront any kind of realities. They never have to confront the realities that Trump on the whole has probably not been so bad for them. And I really appreciated, you know, Eric giving me a shout out on, you know, a couple of episodes back while also pronouncing my name correctly. So I'm going to name check him back for something that he said on that episode, which is, you know, Trump is an expert on trolling the left by kind of calibrating his statements in such a way that the left then fills them in by connecting the dots. The left basically supplies the connections, and then the right points out that a lot of it was done inferentially. And he called this like the dress for politics. And, you know, Trump, I think, sounds or says things that sound like revolting on purpose, because he wants to produce this inferential short circuit so that he can prove himself and his base right about kind of the so-called radical left.
Something I love when people do is when they say something that pisses off both ends of our audience from different directions. So I want to go to the point about Trump being sort of standard neoliberal, because if you are left wing, obviously that's offensive, because you're not even left wing. If you're center left, you're going to say, what are you talking about? Children in cages, Mexicans, various sort of statements you can
China,
pick up.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're on the right, you'd say, wait, he's not neoliberal at all. He was an immigration restrictionist in a really serious way, like the H-1Bs, at least the idea of the border wall, the refugee numbers, the Muslim ban. You have the way that he approached free trade, right? Mm-hmm. The trade war of China is not something that anyone would have sort of done. Obviously, you could critique him on his foreign policy rhetoric, but no new wars is actually a real thing. So what is it about Donald Trump that's neoliberal to you?
Nothing really, you know, or not as much as the previous five guys. But again, you know, you have to pay lip service, right, to this kind of like dominant liberal ideological narrative. You know, it's like on my podcast, I was talking about an op-ed Yanis Varoufakis wrote for The Guardian, where he brought up this really salient point about how if and when Biden gets elected, we don't actually want a return to normalcy. We don't want to go to sleep again. And he had to couch and cushion this with these kind of caveats and qualifications about what a bad, horrible guy Trump was. So I think, like, you know, you kind of got me there, because I think, like, you know, on balance, Trump is probably less bad, and I'll stand by this, I'll die on this hill, less bad than the previous five presidents, just like in terms of like I think he was, you know, too fat and lazy, frankly, to be much of a serious ideologue.
So this is why Sagar opened with the whole question of like, when are you going to come out on the right? So what, separate from the president's weight and sort of various issues, what is it about Trump ideologically or policy-wise that you haven't liked? Right. So I could sort of see the directions where you'd be happier with, at least where he was pointing. What did he do that you didn't like?
I think most of his presidency was sort of a missed opportunity, right? To really kind of cordon off power or take power or meaningfully kind of change the consensus or the status quo. I'm not a policy nut, and I'm not like an economics expert. So I'm like mainly like looking at the aesthetics of it. But I think like, I don't know how practicable or reasonable it is, but I think Trump could have really, there was a brief blip of time where he could have addressed some of the concerns that people in the country have very seriously, you know, especially like the healthcare stuff, the pharma stuff. Me personally, if I was in office, I would tackle factory farming first, because that's such a nexus of all of our social and economic woes and ills, right? But I think, like, if you look at the situation, you know, I want to get to this later because, you know, I guess we're going to talk about kind of the how much the elites suck and kind of the decline of the quality
of life. It's coming.
But think about why we have somebody like Trump in the first place. Well, because, you know, Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. and Clinton sold out our economy, which then practically invited Presidents Bush Jr. and Obama to plunge us into like a series of endless wars to compensate for the lack of an economy, right?
And this is an interesting point where you talked about aesthetics, and this is something you and I had, you know, once connected on. And I think it's something that I want to tease out, and I don't yet know how to think about it, which, because I agree with you. I think the aesthetics of coronavirus is the perfect thing for me, which is that Trump, I mean, one third of the country only trusts Trump on coronavirus, but he didn't do all that bad of a job relative to all of Western Europe or like many of the rest of the world. Or look at Cuomo, right? Like, Cuomo, like, condemns, like, old people to death, not from his own fault, but, like, he still did it. And he's still got, like, a 70% approval rating, right? Like, in New York. And I think about the aesthetics of Trump and, like, how much that actually ended up mattering, not just in Corona, but, like, for his entire presidency. What do you think that says about politics in general when
I mean, look at Biden. Like, all a guy has to do is wear a damn mask. And, like, that was probably a huge part of why he's going to be president. And, I mean, that's something that's, like, not ideological. It's purely aesthetic. What do you think that you can ascribe that to?
Ascribe what to? The kind of...
Just that desire for the, like... I don't even know what it is. I mean, here we're talking about competence aesthetics. But in general, like, the role of aesthetics in politics... And what it says, like, about us and the things that we want really out of our leaders, as much as I think and I want policy to matter.
Yeah, I mean, I want policy to matter too. But frankly, you know, speaking from like the perspective of a woman and somebody who's not political, yeah. It's boring and tedious. Nobody wants to learn about like tax codes or tech right. regulation. And, you know, I think those are probably the two biggest battles. Like, I want to know, I was listening a little bit to the Julius Crane episode. I like him, smart guy. I want to talk about how we can kind of put the kibosh on the runaway powers that the tech industry has. But, you know, frankly, I think most people, it's a little over their head, certainly a little bit over my head. Mm-hmm. And I think the kind of aesthetic thing is something that Trump has certainly exploited and amplified, but he did not invent. First of all, Vladislav Surkov in Russia invented it. But, you know, Trump, again, mainly exposes it and then the media amplifies it. I think the media and the technocrats are just, you know, share the blame with Trump or maybe actually yeah. should shoulder more of it.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm interested in how you described yourself as not being political, because if we're looking at what's so toxic about our environment, it's that everything inherently becomes political even when you don't want it to be. So how do you think of yourself as non-political when you do a podcast that obviously talks about politics or on a political podcast? How do you think about that idea?
I mean, look, I'm a person who's basically interested in psychology and aesthetics. I'm a Lashian. Mm-hmm. And so...
And can you explain who Lash... We haven't talked about Lash on the podcast
before. Yeah,
yeah,
we can... We'll get to this because I think there's a whole nexus of people. Ross Duhat being one of them, Michael Lind, mm-hmm. even David Brooks. They're all kind of secret Lashians. I mean, I can yes. get back to that. But, you know, I'm interested in like what... You know, Bret Easton Ellis calls politics like a theater of like sociology. That's what it is for me. I'm interested in what motivates human beings to act the way they do. Mm-hmm. And I came to this because I was really disappointed and grossed out by like Me Too feminism and the kind of lies women tell themselves to deny themselves their own agency and power. Yeah, I mean, I personally, you know, I started getting into politics out of necessity, not out of interest necessarily.
So because other people weaponized art and, you know, everything into politics, you inherently had to become political.
Yes. Yeah. And look, Zizek has a really great point about this. He has two great points, by the way. The first one that he made on our podcast about how, you know, the obscenity of Trump really lies in the fact that it's not that he lies, it's that he tells the truth. In a way that, you know, in polite society among adults, it's not customary to do so. So his obscenity is not actually being a liar. It's being a truth teller. And the other great point he made is that, you know, we make a big deal about politics becoming an entertainment industry, thanks to guys like Trump. But I think the flip side is a lot more dangerous. It's kind of art and culture becoming a... kind of like a political warfare zone.
Right.
What's a truth that Trump tells that society sort of is rejecting, that the neoliberal elite that we're sort of talking about is rejecting?
Well, like, you know, I think he's completely exploded kind of the seedy underbelly of establishment politics, revealed the kind of morality plays and empathy grabs of Democratic operatives as being completely disingenuous and self-serving.
Yeah, I remember he did once, it was like, he said something like, well, these generals are, you know, going to go sit on these boards. And I mean, the defense press like freaked out. They were like, this, the insinuation that, you know, some of our foreign policy is conducted so that people can cash out is the most unpatriotic and ridiculous. Right, and everybody was like, what are you talking about? Like, it's obviously true. I'm not, it's like, we're not trying to smear everybody. Like, not every general is like a war criminal or like war, you know, blood, whatever, beating the drum in order to get a job at Raytheon. But like, it is just true that like a huge amount of them end up going working and lobbying in this like in this industry. And I'm like, this is so fucking obvious to me. And they end up, like you were saying, just denying these outright truths. One of the things I've always seen with Trump too is that he like, he does what the neoliberals will do or like the more sophisticated people will do, but just like in a less sophisticated way. And so then like people will, you know, graft onto it or whatever, and then it will become a problem. They'll try and point that out, but they're so unable to look at their own hypocrisy. I mean, I'm thinking here about like Trump. Remember the Trump Foundation? Everyone's like, oh, the Trump Foundation, like all this stuff. I mean, I just read the story about like the Biden cancer charity, which only paid out money to its staffers, and it didn't do it. It didn't donate any money to cancer charity. Mm-hmm. But like with Trump, he does that and then also commissions like a $10,000 portrait of himself to just like hang in his lobby. And it's like he does the same thing, just like in a more obscene way. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard, you know, people make the kind of analogy or like metaphor that America today resembles the Soviet Union in its last days. And, you know, I mm-hmm. was born in the Soviet Union. I remember it faintly enough, and I certainly remember kind of the aftermath. And at this point, you know, of course, on some level, this comparison has become like trite and played out. But on the other hand, there are certain things that ring true about it, namely that, like, on an aesthetic level, Trump is a very Russian president. He has the obscenity. He has the obscenity and vulgarity of, you know, a Russian bureaucrat from the last days of the Soviet Union. And, you know, not to mention that the whole kind of climate right now in the kind of left and liberal spheres feels a lot like Pavlik Morozov, like people snitching out their parents for voting Republican, that sort of thing. But yeah, I think, you know, he's a great example. I talked about this a little bit with Eric. He's a great example of what we call stjob, which is like, you know, a performative over-identification that's so extreme that it's impossible to know where somebody stands. In short, he's a troll. And, you know, back to your question, Marshall, about like, you know, what kind of truths does he tell? Well, my favorite truth that he told is that he's never seen a thin person drinking Diet Coke, you know? The man has like...
No, that's such a good... That you're right. That actually is. That's the one that everyone had to nod.
Addicted to Diet Coke, I am outraged by that statement. I'm outraged.
Actually, Anna, I'm glad you brought up the Soviet Union, because something that came out in a lot of the polling, and look, insert statement, exit polls are complicated, we'll hear more, but a lot of recent immigrants, especially in Florida, voted Republican or voted for Trump because of sort of the specter of socialism and sort of that idea. Mm-hmm. As I'm thinking about your background, you're sort of the opposite of that sort of story. Think of the whole, you know, the Vietnamese people who fled after the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and the grandparents are basically boomer conservatives and the grandchildren are sort of DSA members. And this whole Twitter thing to it. But how do you think about that dynamic as terms of the immigrant story and socialism, communism, that sort of part? Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm very jaded and pessimistic about socialism, right? My parents were revolted, repulsed by socialism. I think they suffered tremendously under it. So, you know, my feeling about it is like, I'm sympathetic to all sides. Like, I see what like young American kids who are drawn to this kind of momentum of like Bernie Sanders or AOC or someone, I see where they're coming from, and I'm sympathetic to it, but I... you know, I think they're jumping the gun a little.
Hmm. What do you mean by that? Yeah.
I mean, I think they're naive and they don't understand how a power works in the real world amongst real adults.
You know, it's funny that you say that. I mean, I just saw Bernie, I think he was on Jake Tapper's show on Sunday. And he's like, I don't know anybody out there calling up defund the police. And I'm like, do you like know your protege, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? And just so much of what we're talking about here is, and just to bring it back to kind of aesthetics and more, is that they're like kind of leaning into the worst caricatures that remind, as you said, like your parents, recent immigrants and others from these regimes. Something that Ross said on their podcast, which I thought was really important, because I thought the socialism sucks attack was really dumb. And, you know, I'm on record and I was wrong about it. And one of the reasons why is because I thought that people were tying it to economics, right? But the truth was, and this is what Ross said, is that a lot of these recent images like tie it to the specter of like a like transition in regime and just like statues coming down and chaos. And they're like, actually, like, chaos is terrible. I'm curious if you think that analysis and like dynamic is true, and like what, because then it seems to me then that socialism itself has an aesthetics problem. When what do you think that is?
I don't know. It depends on what kind of socialism we're talking about.
Well, AOC, whatever. How a average American voter would understand it in the vein of like a Bernie and an AOC. I'm not saying that's correct, but like that's how they would see it.
I mean, I think that the primary problem of like socialist aesthetics as they exist now is that they're uncompelling and unsexy. You know, in other words, these are people who are trying to normalize taboos instead of promoting them. They have the terms a little bit wrong. You know, the minute that you normalize something, like sex work, for example, it ceases to have the kind of like seedy or gritty edge that people glommed onto it originally for. And, you know, a lot of them are just basically, I think this moment's over, but a lot of them were like basically just reprising the kind of Soviet space dog aesthetics of the Soviet Union, which was fundamentally, you know, like a revivalist, nostalgic movement. And like all nostalgia had no sense for it, had no actual experience with the thing that it was kind of fetishizing and nostalgizing. I mean, like Mark Fisher talks about this ad nauseum. I think he's probably like the best critic of these nostalgia complexes. But I think like on a more meaningful level, the problem with everybody that we talk about basically in this Twitter sphere is that everyone's a liberal. We're all liberals at the end of the day. You might be a conservative-leaning liberal or a left-leaning liberal, but we all basically believe in certain core tenets, like this myth of progress that basically takes the form, I think, of a total belief in technological advance, in certain kind of human rights and morality-based appeals. So that's I think my bigger issue with kind of the socialist putsch is that it's not aesthetics. It's kind of the underlying unexamined ideology of it.
So would you not describe yourself as a socialist then?
I mean, I don't describe myself as anything. I'm a nothing. I'm like a cipher. I'm a null and a void. I don't identify.
I gotta tell you, people project whatever they want onto you. They truly do. It's like right and left, socialist, anti-woke, apologist, whatever. I mean, how do you deal with that?
I've become kind of desensitized to it. I always remember what Vanessa Place said on our show, which is my critics are always right. You know, it's up to them to project whatever kind of like meanings and significances they want onto me. I won't resist it anymore.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to give Sagar a quick break. What about the original question, which you tweeted about, which is like, are you going to pivot to the right? The sort of thing that people are sort of critiquing in bad faith on Twitter. But what's your response to that question if you're asking it in an interesting, not in an interesting way, but in the correct way? Because something Sagar and I have noticed is that there just are a lot of people who are far more political view in terms of their framing, who will put in their Twitter bio, former leftist or the left left me. And all of a sudden they're just tweeting Trumpy shit and obviously are going for Patreon clicks. So how do you just think about that dynamic?
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to kind of articulate it in tangible terms. I don't subscribe to any of the labels. I think the labels are especially now more and more irrelevant. Saying you're left wing or right wing increasingly means, you know, very little. Because we all know, you know, like the kind of the left wing now is so far gone, has deviated so far from kind of the original, you know, labor left, right? I don't have as good of a grip on what's going on in right wing circles. I'm sure you guys probably have a better sense of that. But, you know, I think that it is all kind of like aesthetic symbolism at this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, my feeling about it to answer the question is like, you know, if I was going to be right wing, I would have gotten a blonde weave and breast implants and a YouTube channel, and I would have been far more successful than I am now. This is small fries.
If we see you moving to LA, we'll understand something's going on.
Yeah. If you need some Fox Booker contacts, I got you. I mean, here's a question I really have, which is that I can hear you. I think there's a lot of people on the right who do this cringe thing where they look for people on the left to like validate what they think is bad about like the others. I'm curious, I mean, for those people, what do you think is cringe about the right? Like, what sucks about the right in America today?
That's a good question that I haven't really pondered excessively. I think my beef with right wingers is that they're kind of victim mongers and empathy lords in their own right, even though they accuse kind of the left of being this way. You know, they have their own identity politics, and they're equally ideologically possessed, just in the other way. You know, there are, you know, a lot of people now on social media making like claims about the electoral fraud that's going on, allegedly, and they're doing it in a frankly very militant and off-putting way. You know, they could strengthen their case, I think, by being more moderate and explanatory to those of us who don't understand, you know, like statistical models, for example, or like math formulas.
Graphs. Well, I think what's funny about what you're saying is that there are a bunch of people who I'm not going to name, who have been tweeting and dunking on the left for Russiagate and all of its excesses over the past 4 years. But within, and I should also add, these same people were saying Trump was going to win by 400 electoral votes. These are real people who are in DC and New York who are saying this. But the second that Trump lost in a very frankly explainable and legitimate way, they turned into complete sort of election truthers without any sort of evidence. And it just is incredibly frustrating. So I get and agree with your point about many people on the right aren't as different than the leftists who they're critiquing in the first place.
Yeah, again, I think this is the narcissism of small differences. You know, the political denomination or orientation is liberal. The psychological type, as Lash talks about it, is narcissist. And of course, people don't want to hear that because, you know, everyone's always fishing for kind of evidence of like hypocrisy. I think being a truffle swine for hypocrisy, by the way, is like the lowest form of discourse. Like, we're all hypocrites and we're all liberals. Like, get a grip, people. But, you know, Lash goes into this quite a bit, and I don't know if we should go into this on this particular podcast.
Let's do it. That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's pretty lengthy and involved. But he talks about kind of how, we live in a time of pathological narcissism, which should not be confused with extreme self-love or grandiosity, that often it is accompanied by feelings of extreme self-loathing, because, of course, narcissists depend on the very people that they resent for their kind of, for the integrity of their ego, right? They derive validation and affirmation externally from others, and they resent this. And I think like it's very interesting to see him being revived now by people like Ross Duhat and Michael Lind and David Brooks, like I mentioned, because you can see, I mean, I'm not accusing anyone of any kind of like cynical gambits here, but to those of us who are initiated, we read their work and we interpret it as an homage. But the fact is most people are not initiated. He's kind of a forgotten thinker. So, you know, his ideas now look very fresh and novel.
I completely agree. You know, it's fascinating. I kind of was one of those people. Like, I got Ross-pilled. Ross put out that. And then I was like, oh, and then, you know, if someone was like, you got to read Christopher Lasher. So I read Revolt. And I remember being like, how did he write this in the 1990s? He like called like the narcissism of like the managerial elite and more. And this is one of the things I really wanted to talk with you about was about just like how much our elite sucks today. And I said this on Tucker's show first. And I said this on our podcast with Eric is like the problem I have is like I'm not anti-elite. It's just that our current elite sucks and they produce subpar outcomes for themselves and for everyone else. And it's like what kind of elite are these people? How do we end up this way?
Really, damn you, Sagar, because you should have waited for me to quote you.
Yeah.
And now you've gone and quoted yourself. But yeah, I wanted to make a point that was
narcissism.
Look at my PMC brain, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, you look at, for example, what's going on with like the kind of internalized, implanted liberal ideology that we all carry around. And, you know, part of like liberal self-fashioning depends so much on those who are now in the mainstream continuing to see themselves as the underdog, you know? Hence the rise of this kind of Lashian narcissistic empathy politics. You see this, you know, with like appealing the appeals to people that are emotional rather than rational, kind of on the basis of your relatability, which now more often than not is basically your adversity. You know, nowadays dramatizing your adversity is, of course, the only way that you make yourself look relatable. For instance, like AOC is the queen of this. She likes to bill herself as like this lowly former bartender from the barrio. She drops her makeup tutorial. She had that recent interview in the New York Times talking about how she almost quit politics because the higher ups in the party were bullying her so much. When she's obviously like their pledge and they're hazing her. And, you know, in Russian, we have this phrase, "Проверка на вшивость," which basically means a shit test, which is what she was undergoing. And, you know, like she and other members of the squad, for example, habitually tweet about how we must challenge kind of the institutional centers of power. And of course, they are the new institutional centers of power. That's what's so preposterous to me about the elites is it's this constant rationalizing and deflecting of power. No, we're just the underdog. It's sort of like what I do, you know, on Twitter. I'm so dumb. I haven't read any books. except I'm like an entertainer, not a politician. And, you know, and it's really irrelevant whether it's lost on them or it's a deliberate rhetorical strategy because it works, you know, the same way. And I was thinking, you know, it's not just her or the squad. I don't mean to pick on them. You know, you saw Biden doing it during the 2020 debates. When Trump was clearly invoking his troubled crackhead son Hunter, and he kept mishearing and harping on his dead war hero son Beau, you saw Hillary doing it every step of the way in both the lead up to and the aftermath to the 2016 election, right? Where she was packaging herself as kind of like a victim of sexism and misogyny, not to mention like, you know, these armies of like Russian trolls or whatever.
Right.
And I think that that's what's so, I guess, for lack of a better phrasing, disgusting and demoralizing.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think that this stems from, and I think it was Michael Lind who I got this from, I don't remember. And he was talking about how the circle of meritocracy has made it such that they're convinced that they earned it when, you know, the old elite, so to speak, like, look, you can, you know, there was a lot of problems in the 1950s, 1960s, 1940s, all that. Okay. All that out of the way. But like, you know, there was like a noblesse oblige. Like, you know, I read George H.W. Bush's biography and I'm like, this guy was like one of the youngest purple. He signs the military and he's like, I got to go and I got to serve my country and all of this. And he's like, and I obviously inherited this wealth and I owe a debt to society and like breezing his kids. Well, you know, it didn't really work out that well with kids necessarily, but it was like something that he like deeply believed. And again, I mean, this is something which I just think is completely missing and makes these people so hollow. There was a tweet I saw somebody was telling me about recently where this was a girl. She was tweeting about like her high school ex-boyfriend who had just gotten married. And apparently he had just gotten married and he was like having a happy life. And she was like, you know, she's like, so funny. Like, just saw my high school boyfriend get married. Like, I live in New York. I own cool stuff and I have an awesome job. She's like, I obviously won. And I just remember being like, you won? Like, that's what winning means? Like, today? Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole different conversation, like, on the kind of failures of feminism, too, kind of the lies that we tell ourselves. But yeah, I mean, this is all, it's all very, like, bleak, and I feel like it's sort of, like, this kind of, like, personal, like, making everything, like, look depoliticized and relatable. You know, for example, you know, if you go back to like the squad or something, I don't know if I'm answering your question. I'm just like, you know, you have this, like, they've been branded or billed as like this uplifting, you know, departure from establishment politics. And they're very much in the kind of direct logical lineage of establishment politics. They're, you know, a direct extension of this liberal self-mythologizing that necessarily has to see itself as like an underdog to cope with the immense power that it in fact wields. And I think that this is like very much what Lash foresaw and was warning against. And, you know, as far as, you know, your comment about Michael Lind and Ross Douthat, that point I think was directly captured by him in Revolt of the Elites, which I believe is from 1994. I mean, we can go into that. It's very kind of symbolic and meaningful Freudian for me that Revolt of the Elites is published in the year that the GATT and NAFTA treaties go into effect, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, could we talk about money? Because
yeah, I love, I'm Armenian and Jewish. I love talking about money.
Great. What's I'm black and Jewish, so I don't really know what the stereotype is there, but we'll work it out. So the question here is, we're talking about how elites are sort of advancing this sort of idea. They think they're the underdog, but the answer to this is actually pretty straightforward, how they sort of reconcile this in their head, and it's money. So right. I was making much of the point that you're making here with someone who used to run a very prominent, basically, I heard you on the podcast with Gwen Gleenwell refer to these tattletale journalists who basically go around, sort of, she runs one of these organizations that basically holds brands hostage to get them to not advertise on Fox.
Puts a gun to their head and says, why are you supporting racists, right?
No. She says, no, what they say is, why are you doing this? We're trying to help you, as they hold the gun to them. Right. Okay. But basically, her point was, I don't have any power because I don't make that much money. I work at a nonprofit. So can you sort of talk about the idea that this sort of elite they were talking about doesn't necessarily correspond with making six figures? AOC could both be a member of the political establishment, be at the time 100, but also be a former bartender. How does that all work together? Because that's where I see people getting confused.
Well, I mean, this, I think, goes back to Michael Lind's argument, right, that you guys so frequently cite about, and you know, you can bring in Peter Turch in here, kind of his elite overproduction thesis, coupled with, like, Lind's horseshoe theory of class difference. I think somebody like AOC absolutely takes advantage of, and frankly, given the system, I don't blame her, of being, let's say, economically working class when she is in fact culturally middle class. There's a lot of mushiness, fudging of those two values that I think are very kind of meaningful. And in America, they're often made to disappear. And I, you know, again, I'm used to like the Russian model where we're constantly diagnosing and parsing the minutiae, like micro minutiae of class warfare. But you take somebody like that, and I count myself in a similar position, right? We have virtually similar backgrounds socioeconomically. Our dads died sophomore year of college. They both had kind of like fairly respectable and affluent white-collar professions. We were economically demoted to working in the service industry, and I think now somebody like her can leverage that into you know, a political brand. Well, I was working class. I think that, you know, I've said this before like a million times. I'm like Quentin Crisp. I repeat myself loudly and often. But the American left, you know, it thinks that it's fighting a class war masquerading as a culture war. And in fact, it's fighting a culture war masquerading as a class war, because the American left is by and large made up of nice, educated, relatively affluent, mostly white people who resent and hate your average culturally working class, but now economically yes. middle class, small businessman, proprietor, boat salesman, whatever.
Right. So this is where your question about cringy right becomes so important, because I could agree with everything you just said when you critiqued the left, but for many people, and we run into this problem with our sort of viewer question and answers, they'll hear this critique of sort of the center left establishment and say, okay, cool. So I'm now a right populist, not recognizing that if you actually look at most of the American right, yeah, it's true. They don't run Hollywood. They don't run the entertainment industry, but they're definitely not supporting the minimum wage increases that people get excited about. Mm-hmm. If I get one more question from someone who says they're on the right about how we could get universal healthcare from the right wing perspective, I'll like punch myself in the face, because that's just not a thing. Mm-hmm. So how do we sort of critique the left without creating a phantom right that doesn't exist? Because that's what so many of the people sort of do here in Sagar. You've seen this too. I'd love you to add your point on that.
Yeah, I see it all the time. No, I just want to hear your answer to that question. I think it's fascinating.
You have to repeat the question. How do we critique the left without playing into a caricature?
How do you critique center left world elites, et cetera, without creating this false image for people that there is a right equivalent that's safe and open and something that's sort of ripe for the taking? Because it seems to me that that's what people never sort of do on it. And that's not what you're doing here, but too many people on Twitter say, do you hate the PMC? Yeah, they're terrible. So join the right, as if that's a thing that you can actually do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I think that the way that you have to critique it for in you know, I don't know if I can even answer that question adequately, because again, I have such a poor grasp myself, you know, coming from like this left liberal terrain of the actual right wing, outside of like people that I've met individually. But I think you have to be kind of brutally, ruthlessly self-critical, right? With where you yourself stand in this cosmos.
Oh, so I actually got a better way of framing this for you. People listen to your episode with Steve Bannon, which I loved, was amazing.
Incredible.
And they think that that's the right. Uh-huh. That's what I'm sort of talking about. People will listen to that episode of Steve Bannon and say, oh, shoot, so there's this guy.
Yeah, and I'm like, I wish.
He wants to raise taxes, but he's also not woke. And they think that doesn't exist. That's not real. So I think as I was listening to your episode this morning to prep, I was like, man, a lot of people listened to this episode sort of like some dissatisfied fail son and really got a just really inaccurate picture of what the
of
other
what
side the
right
of the
wing looks like.
Yes.
I mean, you know, what we're talking about, I think, when we talk about the actual right wing is basically like corporatist liberals, right? Who are libertarians who, you know, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right.
Because I'm like a fish out of water here, but it's, you know, people who believe in kind of bootstrapping and personal responsibility as it existed during the Reagan age and who still believe in kind of like the reign of the small businessman. I mean, I think reality is going to catch up to those people too, because, you know, I say this, you know, somewhat ironically and somewhat in jest, but in my mind, you know, the alternative, the inverse of something like Black Lives Matter is actually not like White Lives Matter or the even cringier Blue Lives Matter, but it's No Lives Matter. Because eventually neoliberal austerity gets to everybody. It gets to us all.
Defund us all is the real right wing position.
Yeah,
I want to get to something you said something so important that I have this goddamn debate all the time with the left about working class. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? I'm almost at a point where I don't even use it anymore.
I don't know what it means
and
anymore.
I try to basically just make it like dividing line is 4-year college degree.
in general, that's generally how you can approximate it. Mm-hmm. Because what you said is that you can be working class and culturally middle class if you look at it by income. In this way, I'm thinking about, or even upper middle class, I'm thinking about like a Vox writer who makes like $35,000, but writes like all these bullshit articles about, you know, woke identity politics. It's like, you obviously are not working class, like, sorry. But let's say you have like a plumber who makes like 90 grand and who lives in small town Georgia. I mean, economically, like, he's not working class, but culturally, I mean, on the aggregate, very likely to be culturally working class. Like, I remember there's that great thing with Charles Murray where he asked people, like, what does the word Branson mean to you? And like, obviously, I'm like, oh, like Richard Branson, right? And like, if you answer that, you actually get minus two working class points, because like the actual answer is Branson, Missouri, which is like the country music capital of America, which I'm ashamed to say I didn't know until I took that quiz. But I guess what I'm trying to get at it is how do you think about that term, working class? And again, I really want people to take away that cultural point that you made, which is that culture itself is power. It's not just derived from income itself.
Yes. Didn't Andrew Breitbart say this?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Politics is downstream.
Pour one out for that guy. You have to think about this in terms of the double horseshoe theory of Michael Lind. I think you have to decouple economic class from cultural class. Very often they're wedded. Increasingly they're not. The left takes advantage of mystifying, obfuscating this distinction. So you have a bunch of people on the left who are like basically millennials our age, who are highly credentialed, highly educated, over-socialized, will insist until they're blue in the face about their working class bona fides, but of course grew up, you can tell by their cadence, by the way that they, you know, pause minutely to say, to recite like a hip hop lyric, you can tell that these people are, culturally middle class.
Yeah.
I'm imagining a hellish test where we make someone read rap lyrics out to test whether or not. I'm like, Mike, read the following three lines and see where you pause.
And like, I really insist on this. I don't know how much more I can insist on it. I say this, you know, I'm being a little bitchy and roasting people because I say this out of sympathy. I think it's, you know, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I think it's a disgrace that educated middle class people have to struggle in this country. I mean, is it not? But, you know, I'm always laughing at AOC because I think not because I have any personal beef with her, but because she's like a prime exponent of this. You know, she doesn't sound like Jenny from the Block. She sounds like, like Rebecca from Jewish Summer Camp, the kind of over enunciated, hyper literate cadence.
Who I think of as the type of person who's in charge of the multicultural center at your school. Exactly. That's where the cadence comes in. That's where the speaking style comes in. And what's so frustrating is we're doing a lot of dunking here. I'm not just trying to dunk because everyone, you know, I think those things actually do matter. And I actually don't have a sort of visceral opposition to identity politics in that way. But you should understand that if you're working at your school's multicultural center, if you're sort of operating in that sort of like Jenny from, you know, summer school perspective, you're not exactly challenging power. You're not exactly upending the establishment in what you sort of do. And that really, and that's something that makes people so angry when you say that. And I was never prepared when I was talking about the person who ran the liberal justice organization. I was not ready for how angry they got when I just made the point that, hey, just so you know, you have more cultural power with your ability to defund Tucker Carlson than a small business owner who makes 150K, but went to a community college. And that's just so contradictory to the internalized narrative that it just causes a reaction.
Yeah, I think people get they get apoplectic, they get enraged when you bring this up to them. And my feeling has always been like, hey, there's no shame. Let's all like hold hands and jump into this abyss together and like parse it out. But the point of this whole empathy politics thing of always insisting on your adversity or your victimhood or your kind of like hard scrabble origins and this sort of thing is, of course, to make your ideological agenda seem unfalsifiable and therefore unassailable. Nobody can attack you because, you know, what kind of a monster are you if yes. you attack a woman, let alone a woman of color, you know? And, you know, we can argue with like Trump versus Biden or Democrats versus Republicans. I happen to think the distinction is pretty meaningless nowadays, as far as the kind of establishment center is mm-hmm. concerned. But who can argue with like voting or going green or being anti-racist, which, by the way, is subtly different from just not being racist, you know?
Yes.
But they
but
will
profoundly different, actually.
It's yes, but they will yeah. also collapse, mystify, obfuscate that distinction, right? You know, and to kind of circle back on something I said earlier, I think it's a maneuver that works perfectly in our age, which is an age of like wild inferential thinking in which you graft, project, you know, it's a, people on Twitter love, it's like their favorite word, you're just projecting, you know. Mm-hmm. And this kind of wild inferentialism, when it's taken to its logical extremes, becomes conspiracy theory and paranoid thinking. And, you know, so, but my beef with the kind of empathy politics that both sides now, I think, are exploiting. You know, you look at somebody like Madison Cawthorn. I was telling Glenn Greenwald, he's a perfect ID poll candidate for the right.
Yeah,
and he's a hot blonde Chad who's wheelchair bound, and like a family man, right? But my beef with it is that, you know, is ultimately how spiritually short-sighted and uncharitable and miserly it is, because it's a zero-sum game and it's like a race to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fundamentally manipulative and extortionate.
Yeah, I think the final thing I wanted to get with you here was something I thought about you during, I'm not sure if you saw it, this Macron interview with the New York Times that mm-hmm. just came out yesterday. And one of the key points about France, right, is they've always resisted kind of like American hegemony, like cultural mm-hmm. hegemony and more. And I'm like, it seems like the worst part about this is that we not only globalized our economy, we globalized our culture and exported this nonsense just like mm-hmm. across the world. I mean, as somebody, you know, obviously, you know, you're deeply familiar with Russia, Armenia and more, like, how do you see that as one of our worst, like one of the worst things that we actually ended up doing?
So quick thing, Sagar, I want to give a little more context on this story because I don't think everyone's quite up on the NYT paywall. So what happened is Sunday, we're recording this on Monday, an interview with President Macron where he talked about how the U.S. is American and British papers are critiquing his efforts to combat Islamism in mm-hmm. France by saying it's racist, by saying he's not focused on equity, and then they're bringing this American BLM summer 2020 context into France, and he's pushing back against that. Mm-hmm. And we heard you, and you actually you made this really great point on Eric Weinstein's podcast where you're talking about how the most annoying thing we do is we take our racialized history, which is awful in a million different ways that we could name, obviously, in a different episode, but it exports it to other countries. So we're interested in how do you just think about that export and how the internet enables that and how we sort of can't think of these things outside of that weird globalization?
Well, there's a lot of parts to this. Number one, I mean, leave it to the French to make racism charming. They really have a talent for it. And also leave it to the French to combine traditionalism and neoliberalism.
Yes.
It seems impossible.
That is Macron, right? Like Jupiterian traditional neoliberal.
And,
but you have to respect it, though.
He's fighting a losing battle, but you know you have to commend him for trying.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Anna.
No. But yeah, I mean, I think it's alternately reprehensible and comical. And you know, I think we know that the most kind of persistent ideologies are those that kind of successfully manage to package themselves as non-ideological, that appeal to basic human values and morals. It has to go down easy. And, you know, I think the problem, I said this on my show before, and I think Amy Therese Laba said it on Twitter recently, you know, all of these kind of progressive and woke tentacles of liberal ideology, of its industrial complex, anti-racism being the most prominent one, but also like anti-imperialism, climate change and stuff like that, depend on the continued existence of the very thing that they claim to oppose. you can't have anti-racism mm-hmm. without racism, and you can't have Antifa without, you know, some constructed semblance right. of fascism. And yeah, I don't know. I think it's completely bizarre and awkward for kind of the American racial discourse to be transferred into countries that have no similar context or history. I mean, I thought it was super weird during the George Floyd protests to see entire protest movements being exported out to like yeah. Amsterdam and Paris.
I was just
right?
thinking Amsterdam. I was like, Amsterdam?
Well, that
like
was the first one. Yeah, yeah. That yeah. was like, I was like, okay. And then you realize, you know, going back to the No Lives Matter thing, you realize that really, you know, George Floyd, as horrible and tragic as what happened to him, he's in some sense like a proxy martyr for the reality, for the real reason people were coming out in droves, which is they were mourning the end of their own lives and prospects because of COVID and the subsequent lockdowns. Mm-hmm. And I think they were legitimately suffering, but they had to lend a kind of morally justifiable, you know, like excuse to it or rationalize it somehow. I think that that's, I mean, this goes back again to the way that like our elites deflect and rationalize their own power in exporting these sort of ideologies through media and academia primarily to the rest of the world. Because, you know, Christopher Lash talks about this, of course, the elites, our elites are effectively now global elites, right?
Yes.
So the elites in Moscow and Berlin and I don't know, Shanghai have more in common with one another than they don't.
So I'll wrap with this, and this isn't related to policy. It actually goes back to the aesthetic point we started with. You weren't what I was expecting. Sagar, you two have spoken. We've never sort of spoken.
Yeah.
And I'm just noticing that on a podcast, your sort of presentation is different than your presentation on Twitter. So like you're not being sarcastic. You're actually being like very, very nice. Not that you wouldn't be nice, but
am
I just
I more
mean,
or less of a bitch?
No, wait, like I'm not gonna engage too hard, but no, you're genuinely like a very like friendly person, and I'm getting that through Zoom. But like your Twitter is like very sort of sarcastic and biting oftentimes. So as an entertainer, how do you just think about like the aesthetic presentation that you have, right? And everyone sort of performs in these spaces differently. And I'm just sort of noticing at least in terms of how I interpret it, how do you just think about that?
I don't really. I've never thought about it. I just express myself the way that I like would ordinarily. I'm a very shy and timid person. And the reason I started a podcast was literally to get over my social anxiety. That's like all there is to it. The way that I tweet is not intentional or branded in any way. I think, again, this goes back to like this kind of export of like monoculture across the globe. It's just the way that I think Russian people and Russian immigrants communicate with each other. My mom is very brusque and bitchy. And I think like every time she's like met one of my boyfriends, they've like cowered away with their tail between their legs because they think she's being mean to them and she's not. I think it's a... kind of like that sort of thing that a lot is lost in translation, and now that it's become basically criminal and pathological to discuss like racial and ethnic and cultural differences, it becomes more and more hopeless every day for me to like try to communicate why I am the way I am, which is fine, you know, I'll like take it on the chin, but yeah. I guess that's all I have to say about that. But
that's fair. I was just curious.
But it's yeah. I mean, it's depressing. I think just if I may go back to kind of this point that Sagar you made about not being kind of against elites in theory or in principle, but being against our current crop of elites because they suck. I think that that's what we have to think about in the for the future moving forward. I don't want to use the term like restore because that sounds a little too trad for my liking. I'm not against trad, by the way, because I find it to be reprehensible. I'm against.
Well, you have a huge trad fan base, by the way.
Yeah,
I'm not
yeah.
sure if you know that.
I don't really. I really have no sense for this kind of stuff. I'm going to do that typical female thing where I deflect away all.
Yes, right.
But I'm not against it because it's reprehensible. I'm against it because it's impractical. But, you know, we were talking about this a little bit about how. Even rich people now live under this kind of regime of aesthetic poverty now. Yes. They're so like aesthetically malnourished. They don't understand quality or luxury except as like a direct monetary exchange. The more it costs, you know, the more luxurious it must be. I know people who are like famous and or millionaires and, you know, they live in like overpriced open plan, like austerity, masquerading as decadence.
They get you
like on the finishes and the amenities, but like her building is like, you know, the layout is perilous and inhumane, and the building is like built on like an Indian burial ground or like a toxic spillage site or something. And like I want to you know, try to figure out how to bring back the good points of that model. You know, I was watching, going back to the comment that I made on like GATT and NAFTA, I was watching an old episode of Charlie Rose, and he was interviewing Sir James Goldsmith. I don't know if you're familiar with this guy. He was an old school corporate raider who did an about face, kind of as I'm assuming his personal fortunes took a nosedive and started agitating against free trade and globalization toward the end of his life. He's really brilliant, you know, articulate guy, but on that program he talks about kind of the existential threat of GATT and NAFTA. Everyone focuses on NAFTA, but he's more interested in GATT because it's the bigger, more wide-ranging, more dangerous trade agreement. And he proposes, you know, this is 1994, again, the year that Revolt of the Elites is published. He proposes submitting it to a referendum, and he talks about how in countries like France and the UK, you know, 30% are for it and 70% are against it. I'm sure you guys can figure out what the class distribution of that percentage breakdown is. And it's probably not much different from what we're looking at now. And he's kind of almost like reprising Peter Thiel's argument or introducing Peter Thiel's argument 15 years earlier. But the thing that I remember, like I was like sitting in the car, you know, on a long drive, and you can see like revisiting this interview like 30 years later that this referendum, I mean, there was in fact a referendum, but it was delayed. I mean, what is Brexit, right? If not a delayed referendum on the GATT trade agreement. And so I go back to like, I watch these old episodes of like Charlie Rose, and I think like, man, this is what like TV used to be. I long for the era of like Gore Vidal versus William F. Buckley. You can't have Gore Vidal now. We don't even deserve William F. Buckley, right? Because, you know, you look at all the media gays and they're like shilling for Pfizer. And like,
so this is, I have to ask you this, then we'll let you go.
Yeah.
Part of the shtick of long form podcast people is that actually, Anna, we are getting back to that. And there's this whole intellectual dark web, and Joe Rogan goes for 5 hours. So actually, we are living this age where you can't have these debates. What do you think about that argument? Because it doesn't seem like you're optimistic about the format.
Well, I'd kick that question to you. What do you guys think about it? Are you optimistic about it?
This is why I love how you talked about like naivete earlier on, because when you talk to people who extol this format and extol the conversations that we're having outside the mainstream media, and unlike Rachel Maddow and Sean Hannity, the people who listen to our podcast want to be told the capital T truth. It's bullshit. It's actually just not true. It's unclear to me that anyone in any of these spaces has actually constructed a narrative that isn't mostly just self-serving to the audience. I mean, this is the nature of sort of the Patreon economy, right? Which is that the objective isn't to get 30 million people to listen to you. It's to get 50,000 people to pay. It's to get, you know, 10,000 to sort of those sort of dynamics there. So I just don't, I like Joe Rogan. I like the show. Insert statement about that. It's been huge for the show's growth, but let's not pretend that Joe isn't also serving his own narrative that helps his audience too. But Sagar, what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough, because I mean, what you're talking about there, that Charlie Rose, like Gore Vidal, Buckley, it was such a unique like market moment in time. And I think about too, just like, look, I mean, like I said, I should be self-serving, be like, yeah, alternative media, like destroying the MSM. Like, look, I'm gonna be honest here. Like, it's just not true. Like, I want it to be true. I would love to solve that economic problem, but I'm not. Like, 12 million people watched CNN. Only 1.5 million people watched my election live stream. 1.5 million is still a lot, but it's not 12 million, or it's not like 20 million whenever it comes to Fox. And so I'm like, okay, well, you know, for every, you know, they literally have a 12x multiplier on their power and like what they have, and in terms of where it is right now. And for every person, I think about this too. I'm like, for every person who listens to Rogan or like listens to this pod or listens to your pod or long form, like all of that, like most people just want like a 5-second clip on Instagram, you know, of like, and I'm like, I don't know if you can ever compete with that. I really don't.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I'm still waiting. I mean, maybe I'll make an appeal on your podcast to my simps and pay pigs that if anybody wants to write like a Vox style explainer of the electoral fraud that may or may not have occurred, I'm all ears. I would really like to understand it. But yeah, no, I mean, I think like what we're doing is probably useful and fulfilling on some level for people. I get a lot of messages that are like, you know, between the ones asking me if I've gotten work done or screaming at me that I should just come out and say that I'm MAGA. I get a lot of messages saying like, okay, like you and Dasha are the only people keeping me sane right now. But on the other hand, I'm not super optimistic. I don't hold out more hope, and it's through no fault of our own. I think the whole model has changed because there's such a surfeit of information and everything is so attention based that even kind of the nature of popularity or visibility, or if you want to be crude about it, like fame, it has changed. Even if you are extremely visible and influential, it never quite takes hold. And it's always somewhat fleeting and forgettable. Yeah. And so when I say, like, you know, I want to go back to the days when people are having legible and exciting discussions about trade agreements on public programming, I want to figure out moving forward, like that's my hope for the future, how to extract kind of the high points, the benefits of that old model and reapply them today, how to, you know, update them. And, you know, I have a lot of questions now, whether it's possible to create a new institutional framework from the ground up, and how you could avoid that institutional framework from becoming just another kind of site of internecine squabbling and warfare and callouts.
Such a good point.
And that's... Yeah. I'm happy we're ending there because we talked about the abyss, and I think that is a semi sort of moment for hope here, because we talk about the future of media a lot. You talk about media, especially with, you know, talking of Glenn about going to Substack. It is possible to cheaply do this. Like, this podcast we're recording isn't the most expensive thing in the world. I actually worked on the PBS reboot of Firing Line 2 years ago, which is, you know, something that cost, you know, millions of dollars to put together, getting the same sorts of guests that we're getting here. So I think this is something that people can be optimistic about and not just think that we're doomed.
No. I guess my last word, my question is whether any sort of extra institutional movement could ever have any real lasting impact, and whether it needs an institutional infrastructure to achieve that. Anyway.
Well, we can't actually, we got to keep going for that one, because that's a good question. Here's the answer. Yeah, and here's the answer. It has to take power seriously, which this goes back to your earlier point. I'm thinking about, there's this guy who listens to Rising. He invited me on his podcast to talk about these sort of issues, and he's talking about the DNC, and he's talking about conspiracies and all these sort of things. I said, hey, like, just so you know, like, Joe Biden actually won more popular votes in the South. Like, there isn't this crazy dynamic here. And he was just sort of floored by it. He didn't really have a compelling response. He said, but Marshall, the superdelegates. I'm like, no, that's a 2016 thing. You're confusing 2016 narratives with 2020 narratives. Mm-hmm. So what he was doing here, and I like this person, is he was not taking power seriously. And he was engaging in narrative discussion rather than actually engaging with anything on the ground. So the reason why you're not going to see people who hold that opinion take power or seriously change the discussion is they're more interested in having internally facing discussions. And it does matter that this is on happening on a podcast. It does matter that the typical response from a guest like me would have been, yeah, dude, I totally agree, man. The left is just so corrupt and the right is so corrupt and we're all just so corrupt, except for our audiences. That's why it doesn't happen. That's the doom loop everyone gets caught in.
Yeah. To be fair, I still don't know what a superdelegate is or what Super Tuesday is. So you might want to rephrase.
What do you need
question.
To? You're much better off than we are. I just want to put that out there.
Yeah.
Okay. I loved this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having
for
me.
Coming on. Anytime. Seriously.
See you guys in hell.
Yeah. Thank you.
Into the abyss. Let's go. Thanks so much for listening to the episode, guys. As a reminder, if you could leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, it really helps other people find the show. And if you want to ask us a question, you can leave a written review there or take a screenshot of your 5-star review. Send in your question to realignmentpod@gmail.com. As always, a shout out to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring our work here on this podcast. Without them, it wouldn't be possible, and we thank them every day. We will see you guys on Thursday.